Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 127, Patrick here, CJ Evolution. Whatever you are doing, wherever you are at, thank you for tuning in. Without your support, without you sharing the podcast with your family and friends and listening for yourself, I would not be here. Thank you so much for the support. It's happened again. Two brave heroes slain in the line of duty down in Kissimmee, Florida. Thoughts and prayers go out to the family members and friends of these two brave heroes that were slain down in Florida. This crap has got to end, folks. This war on police, we've talked about it before. It has got to end. For those listeners out there, do not believe those people that are ranting and raving on TV about how evil law enforcement is. That is not representative of the majority of people in this great country that support you and what you're doing every day. You are all heroes. Thank you for the continued service that you do every day, doing a very difficult job in a very difficult environment. But law enforcement, most people know this, it's cyclical. We go through good times and bad times. We happen to be in, I think, a bad time right now, but we'll come out of it, folks. But you have the support, so don't ever forget that, of millions of Americans. I'm very excited to have Kathy Filon on today. She's a PhD, and she's going to talk about how we can make criminal justice better, how we can make the job of first responders better. It takes education and a little open mind, but she has a good message, and I'm glad to have her on the show. So without further ado, the one and only Dr. Kathy Filon. Welcome, everybody, back to CJ Evolution. I am privileged and honored to have Kathy Filon on, Dr. Kathy Filon on, I'm sorry. And she has a PhD in criminal justice. She teaches criminal justice at Harrison College, and she is the CEO of Good Harbor Institute. Welcome, Dr. Filon. Thank you for being here, ma'am.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Patrick. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Now, do you want me to call you doctor? Do you want me to call you?
Please. Call me Kathy. I would prefer okay. Kathy. Thank you.
Okay. Well, you've earned your PhD, so I want to be respectful. I gave a little bit about you, Kathy. Can you tell the listeners a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. I have this really kind of bizarre journey that I've been on for my career. So I have worked as a paramedic, a licensed paramedic in the state of Michigan. Mm-hmm. That led me down the path of working in emergency management, which also led me down the path in working in campus law enforcement and working in campus emergency management. So I worked at colleges and universities in emergency management. And while I was doing that, I was pursuing my PhD in criminal justice. Mm-hmm. And when I finished that degree, I decided to take on something different, and I actually took on a position working domestic violence advocacy with survivors of domestic violence and did court advocacy. So I would attend court with those that had survived domestic violence and sexual assault, really be their support person, but then also help them interpret what was happening in the court system. And after doing that for a period of time, an opening came to actually work with the court as a program director for family court. So I took that opportunity, and in that, I got to supervise juvenile probation, but I also worked with our truancy intervention program, and we had a number of court volunteers, court-appointed special advocates that advocated for children in neglected abuse cases, and so I did all of their training and support.
Well, thank you for all your service. I mean, you just have I like it, Kathy, because you have different perspectives from different positions, obviously, you were in. So that brings just so much to the table, right?
Absolutely. It's really interesting to, be on the side of law enforcement or be on the side of working as a paramedic as a first responder, two very different ways to work as a first responder, and then to be on that other end of the criminal justice system, actually working in the court or working, in front of the court.
Mm-hmm. Now, I told the listeners you were the CEO of the Good Harbor Institute. Kathy, can you tell us what that is?
Absolutely. So when I was working at the court, I came across a study called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study that was actually conducted in the late 1990s by the Centers for Disease Control. And what they did was they looked at 10 kind of childhood traumas or adversities, and they screened adults to see how many of these adults had how many of these 10 childhood adversities. And then they compared that to what had happened with these adults in regards to their medical records. And what they found was that the more childhood adversity out of these 10 that an adult had, the more likely they were to have things like heart disease, stroke, diabetes, so real medical conditions. Mm-hmm. In fact, they found a greater correlation between childhood trauma and lung cancer than secondhand smoke and lung cancer.
Wow.
Huh. And what was really intrigued me was that this original study was done with a population that you wouldn't usually consider if you were to, you know, just say, oh, who might have experienced childhood trauma? This population of adults, there were 17,000 of them. They were white, middle class, and most of them college graduates.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a group of people that had really had some kind of, you know, success in their adult life. And so I found that really intriguing, because then it also showed some of the behavioral things that as those childhood traumas reports increased, then you were more likely to have, for example, struggle with addiction, mm-hmm. to struggle with depression, all of those kinds of things. And I started to dive into that research a little deeper and found some other studies directly related to those in the juvenile justice system, because, of course, that's what I was doing at that time. And I really wanted to understand kind of this revolving door that I saw between the neglect and abuse side of the court and the juvenile probation side of the court. Mm-hmm. So we saw kids come in through the neglect and abuse side of the court. Their parents' rights were being terminated, and they were going into the foster care system. And then a few years later, those kids were walking through the doors of juvenile probation.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to understand why that was happening, and then, more importantly, what could be done differently.
Mm-hmm.
Or we saw, you know, that there were families that mom or dad had been on juvenile probation, or grandparents had been on juvenile probation, and then mom or dad, and now the kids were. And so, you know, just this idea of, like, what's going on? How can we change this?
Yeah, and it's about education. It's about knowledge, right?
Well, it is about education and it isn't. So mm-hmm. that's what actually made me interested in starting Good Harbor Institute with my colleague, Shenandoah Scheffalo. Let me tell you briefly about her. Shenandoah Scheffalo is an author. She wrote the book Garbage Bag Suitcase, a foster care memoir, about her experience aging out of the foster care system when she was 18. She mm-hmm. self-reported when she was 13 in the state of Michigan. And she then went on to graduate from Michigan State University and be very successful as a law office administrator.
Mm-hmm.
But she came across the same study, and her and I joined forces because what we found out was there were a lot of people that were getting information about this study, but then they didn't know what to do with that information. So, mm-hmm. you know, I read this study, it tells me these terrible facts. Okay, now what? And so we formed the Good Harbor Institute to share with people now what. We actually developed a training curriculum to translate that information on trauma into skills that anyone could use to build resilience in others. Because another very interesting study came out, and that was by the Center of the Developing Child at Harvard University. And they did a study on resilience. So why is it that some kids experience horrific trauma but come out on the other side of things as pretty resilient, where other kids don't?
Yeah, why is that? Out of curiosity, why?
Yeah, and actually what they found were three things. The number one thing that made a difference in a kid being resilient versus not being resilient was that the kids that had just one, not two or three, but just one positive, stable adult relationship tended to be more resilient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm a big proponent and you probably know this, Kathy, that, you know, if you have those positive people in your life, you just said, chances are you're going to be more successful rather than if you're just surrounded by negativity all the time. So it makes sense to me.
Right. Well, and what's even more fascinating, so I'm, you know, one thing that a PhD gifts you is this ability to say, okay, I just don't want you to tell me something. I want to find out why.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I wanted to know, okay, so why is that?
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually really good science behind it, and it's brain science, which I never thought that I would be someone that would be interested in the neurobiology of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens when, especially when children are exposed to any kind of childhood adversity or trauma, their brain, because it's so rapidly developing, I mean, when you think about a kid, when, you know, baby's born, they're not doing anything, and a year later, they're walking, right?
Yeah.
So that brain develops very fast. If that brain develops in any kind of traumatic situation, so any kind of trauma, it can cause the brain to get stuck in fight, flight, freeze.
Mm-hmm.
It can cause the thoughts of that child to go down that pathway of fighting, running away, or freezing first before doing anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're in that fight, flight, freeze mode, executive functioning actually shuts down. Because, you know, if you're on a trail and a bear jumps out in front of you, you're not thinking about your 10-year strategic plan, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true, yes.
So that part of your brain shuts down, and your fight, flight, freeze kicks in. Well, these kids, their fight, flight, freeze kicks in to the point that anything can be perceived as a threat. So someone dropping a book in the classroom can, because they're already hypervigilant,
mm-hmm.
because their brain is developed that way. Now, what happens when you interject a positive, stable adult relationship? It gives them the opportunity to develop different pathways in their brain because they're in a safe environment, because it's a stable, positive adult relationship. And it doesn't need to be long-term either. It could be something that, you know, is maybe a relationship, positive, stable adult relationship with a teacher or a coach, but not their entire childhood, as
yeah.
long as it ends in a positive way.
And I think when you say trauma, I think most people, and I know I think of something just, you know, horrific or somebody dying or something like that, or maybe a bad car accident, which are all traumatic, obviously. But trauma could be something like a divorce, couldn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, it could be something, I mean, that is very traumatic for children to go through. And, yeah, so it just doesn't have to be like we typically think of trauma. I know I do. I can't speak for anybody else, but when I hear the word trauma, I think it's being just horrific. But we have to remember that trauma could be something, you know, like divorce, which is very traumatic, not just for
right.
parents, but for children especially too, correct?
Absolutely. In fact, this original study, that was one of the traumas. So the 10 traumas that they looked at were some of them that we typically think of: physical abuse, sexual abuse, physical neglect, emotional neglect. But then knowing that your mother or stepmother was being treated violently, not actually seeing it, but knowing that it was happening. Losing a biological parent to divorce, separation, or something like adoption.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Having a family member incarcerated, having a family member who lives in your household struggle with addiction, or living with someone who has a mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
So some of those, yes, I really, you know, we typically think of, like, if you're physically abused as a child, that's probably going to leave a pretty, you know,
exactly.
significant impact. But how many times do we think about, like you said, parental separation? You know, people that are adopted.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
do we consider that? And what's intriguing to me is, you know, there's all of this great information that's being passed about this study, this adverse childhood experiences study. But there's not enough information telling us what we can do differently. And that's exactly why we formed Good Harbor Institute. And so we use a coaching model, and we specifically designed our curriculum for non-clinicians, because clinicians get a lot of this training. But those of us that are first responders
yeah.
don't. Those of us that are in the classroom as teachers don't get this kind of training. And we wanted it to be something that was accessible, that could be used by anyone at any time.
And that was going to be my next question. How can the Good Harbor Institute assist first responders? But it sounds like, I mean, you covered a lot of it. Just through education and...
Well, and training and how
training.
To use the skills. So
okay.
it's actually, we teach a different kind of language. First, we teach this language of, instead of asking somebody why they did something, assume that people don't choose, you know, I always tell people, think about an infant. How many babies have you ever met that were evil, right?
True, yes.
So if we start there, then we know at some point something happened to change this baby into whoever this person is in front of us that's done something horrific. And asking why they did it, you know, in certain certain circles, of course, that's an important question.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But other circles, it's not, because we don't really need to know why you did it. We need to know, okay, what's going on? What led up to why you did this?
Mm-hmm.
Because if we're ever going to stop it, if we're ever going to change it, we need to understand why it happened.
Interesting.
And so it's beginning to change language.
And I was going to ask you, what's the language of trauma care, Kathy?
Really, the language of trauma care is not assuming that people do things just to be evil. That instead, something else is going on. And that we, so every opportunity, every interaction we have with anybody, you know, in our work in law enforcement, in the courts, or just in our work as an everyday human, we have this opportunity to build resilience in others, because Harvard found it doesn't just work with kids, it works with anybody.
Sure.
And we know it doesn't have to be a long period of time. So if I serve as that positive, stable adult in every single interaction I have, I could be building resilience. I'm planting those seeds of resilience. So the drive-through at the fast food restaurant, you know, take my sunglasses off, I look at that person, I really see that person, I ask how they're doing, and I don't just give them, you know, hey, how are you doing?
Oh, you're taking an interest in them.
Absolutely.
You're being genuine. Yeah.
Right. And that moment could build resilience. But the other thing we teach, that we train on, is for me to be able to do that in all settings, I have to understand what my own stuff is. So when my buttons are pushed, I have to understand why that's happening.
Sure.
And what's going on. Because, so I use this example a lot. You know, when I worked with kids in the juvenile justice system, they know how to push buttons, right?
Yeah. No.
And when a kid's pushing my button, I can't go, okay, well, this is the time that I'm going to go do that self-care stuff. So excuse me a moment, I'm going to go out and practice some yoga, or I'm going to go for a run, right? You've got to stay present with this kid, and you can't escalate the kid, because you've got to serve that stable, positive adult relationship. You've got to serve as that stable person, even though you're not condoning what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
My escalating isn't going to help that kid at all. And so for me to be able to not go into my own stuff when my buttons are pushed, because when my buttons are pushed, it's really about my own stuff.
Exactly.
It's about, you know, what am I being triggered about? So I've got to understand what my triggers are, and then I've got to recognize when it happens. I need to understand what it feels like when it happens, and I have to very quickly react and bring my own brain out of that fight, flight, freeze, and bring it back on board to executive functioning.
But I think, and you would probably agree, Kathy, imagine, is some people don't know what their triggers are, and some people just fly off the handle. I mean, I think some, you know, maybe the same people kind of have an idea. But like you said, I mean, it's knowing thyself and knowing what your triggers are, really doing some self-reflection to kind of avoid these instances where you're just letting people get to you. Now people are going to get to you, you know, sometimes, but if you know more about yourself and do some self-reflection, I think, you know, it's less likely to happen.
Right. Well, and then, you know, okay, so I have teenagers, and I can't say that I've gone through every moment of parenting.
Well, I have teenagers, never, too.
Never reacting. And when those things happen, then I have to take afterwards, go, okay, what went on there?
Yeah.
I have to be willing to say, I need to do better, and then figure it out. And it's a journey. And I'm not going to tell you that I don't sometimes get steamed when somebody cuts me off in traffic.
Oh, yes. You're human. I mean, everybody's human.
Right.
But, I mean, that's going to happen. But I think, you know, I mean, you have, you know, I'm the same way, Kathy. I mean, I get steamed too. But then I'm like, okay, it's just traffic. It's just somebody, I'm not going to let this, you know, ruin the rest of my day. I might be mad for a little bit, but I get over it very quickly.
Right. And then going back and saying, why did that make me mad? What was that about?
Exactly.
You know, is it because I left too late?
Yeah, was it something on my end? Now I'm in a rush, like you said. Now I'm late for work, and this guy just, you know, cut me off, so it's his fault. No, it's my fault.
Right. But, you know, beginning to do that work, and it very much is a journey. So my colleague, Shenandoah, talks often about her husband, after about 20 years of marriage, and after her book came out, said, you know what, every time I touch you on your right shoulder, you flinch. And she said, she looked at him and said, you're crazy. And then about a week later, he touched her on her right shoulder, and she all of a sudden noticed she does flinch. And she was like, okay, what's that about? She had never noticed it, and he had never brought it up. But now that the book was out, he was like, okay, let's take this opportunity to look at these things. And she realized that growing up, when her stepfather used to be physically abusive to her, he always grabbed her by her right shoulder when he dragged her out of the room. And it was something that she was doing completely unconscious and never thought about, never saw. So sometimes it takes a moment of someone pointing it out to us, and then us doing that hard, painful work of, like, what's going on? Why do I do this? And what's it about?
So how do you translate evidence-based trauma information, and we covered some of it, but a little bit more into it, into real skills for sustained change?
So because we work with non-clinicians, and I'm not a clinician, we want to be able to train people to understand that neurobiology of trauma. So what happens to your brain in fight, flight, freeze, and what happens to your brain when good stuff, building resilience, happens? And then what can we do to use that language of building resilience? So we use a coaching model. We essentially teach people to be coaches in all settings. And we do a lot of role playing. We talk a lot about those opportunities of examining, again, what's going on with ourselves. So we can be those good coaches. We can be those stable, positive people. And so that's what we do, is we first examine the biology of neurobiology of trauma, the neurobiology of building resilience, and then we give you skills based on a coaching model of how to help build resilience in others.
Excellent.
And we tell people, you know, this is not stuff that we want you to just do when you're, you know, in your work setting. Because if you're going to become fluent in a language, you need to use it everywhere. Mm-hmm. So we encourage people to use it with their families, at the grocery store, when they're cut off in traffic.
Interesting. We talked a little bit about the revolving door in the criminal justice system, Kathy, just changing gears a little bit. What do you think? How do we fix that? And you're talking about, I'm assuming, recidivism and high recidivism rates. You know, you talked a little bit about with juveniles where you're just this revolving door. Same, you know, the recidivism rates in this country are through the roof with adults. I mean, what is there any fix to this, or are we going to continue to see this? I mean, I think you're doing just a great job with what you're doing with the Good Harbor Institute. But what else can we do?
I think that we really need to understand and back up to, you know, why are people ending up in the criminal justice system? Mm-hmm. Why do we have so many people that have spent at least one day in foster care that are now in our criminal justice system? So we need to look at, where are we putting our resources? You know, are we putting our resources in building more prisons? Or are we putting our resources in preventing neglect and abuse? Are we putting our resources into preventing some of this childhood adversity, strengthening our foster care programs, providing more training for our foster care parents? Mm-hmm. Because until we start to do those things, we're going to continue to see this happen. Until we really invest in parenting, and when we invest in parenting, we need to look at, sometimes the parents that aren't doing a good job are the parents that had parents who didn't do a good job, who had parents who didn't do a good job. So instead of blaming, we need to step in early enough that we can then support.
But what do you do to those people out there? And I agree with you. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. I mean, you know that. I mean, if you look at a kid that's going through some stuff, or some difficult, you know, they've suffered trauma, like you said. I mean, the parents probably have. There's a pretty good indication. But what do you do for those people out there, Kathy? And there's many of them who don't want to help, who don't want the help of, like, institutions like the Good Harbor Institute, and they're not willing to change. I mean, what do you? Because there's a lot of people out there like that. I mean, it's great if everybody, you know, is willing to change and willing to educate themselves. So what do you tell the people that don't care?
Well, what's really interesting, first of all, Good Harbor Institute, we usually work with organizations. So we work with organizations that are working with people.
Okay.
So we're working with agencies that do foster care. We're working with schools. So organizations that have that opportunity. But here's the bottom line. So when someone seems abrasive, when they seem aggressive, when they seem like they do not want your help, what mode are they in? Where are they at? They're in fight, flight, freeze. I can't yank them out of fight, flight, freeze. But what I can do is continually be that stable, positive person. So, you know, it kind of comes back to this idea of you can push my buttons, but guess what? They're not on.
Yeah,
I'm going to continue to give you the same line, and I'm going to sit here and I'm going to tell you until the cows come home the same thing. You're not going to push me away. I'm not going to walk away. I'm not going to abandon you. And maybe it makes a difference, and maybe it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Maybe you don't get to see that difference.
Mm-hmm. But like you said, consistency is important, yeah, and being consistent. Yeah,
consistency and that understanding that, you know, we're not going to fix everyone, you know, in 6 months or in a year. And it may be that we just planted a seed, and 10 years down the line, that seed finally takes root and blooms.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, you were in law enforcement for a while, Kathy, I'm sorry. I'm in law enforcement. I know a lot of people listening are. Law enforcement is responding to more and more calls for people who are suffering from mental illness. Why do you think this is the case? Do you have any tips and suggestions for those first responders out there? I know myself, my agency, the numbers are through the roof, and I imagine I know for a fact the agency surrounding our agency they're going through the roof too, and I imagine nationwide.
Well, and what's interesting, because I worked in campus law enforcement, and of course in campus law enforcement we have some of, you know, the most, you know, devastating cases of mental illness not being treated and leading to horrific consequences. But what's difficult in law enforcement is we're first responders, and so we are trained to be hypervigilant. We are trained to kind of be in that mode of fight, flight, freeze, because we're in survival mode. We have to be.
Sure, yeah.
Because we have to protect ourselves. But how do we balance that fight, flight, freeze mode with also this idea of, you know, I need to approach someone and I need to understand it's not about me. They're not acting out against me. This is not personal, and kind of remove that piece of it. So I'm still hypervigilant. I'm still going to keep myself safe, but I'm also not going to make it personal. Because I think a lot of times what, you know, the stuff that gets popular on YouTube in regards to videos that are anti-law enforcement are those videos where you see someone who's, you know, unfortunately, an officer has kind of stepped out of that mode. They're in fight, flight, freeze, that hypervigilance, and they're taking it personal.
Mm-hmm. So it's just a matter of, like you said, just watching our officer safety, but kind of not taking it personally.
And well, and that's where the self-work comes in. You know, that's where we need to know ourselves really well.
Exactly. Talk about stress for a little bit. First responders, you know, I mean, you've been there, Kathy, first responders, and a lot of other people too. I mean, it doesn't have to be first responders, but first responders suffer a lot from stress. Do you have any tips and suggestions on how to cope with stress? Huge health implications with too much stress, obviously. There's good stress too, like eustress. I think some of us know that, but most of us suffer from bad stress, correct?
Absolutely. In fact, part of our training, we break stress down into actually three different tiers. So the foundation tier of care for self-care for stress is what we call daily self-care. So what are those things that I'm going to do for myself every day? I tell people, you know what? I get up in the morning and I brush my teeth because it's good for me, right? But it's also pretty considerate to everybody around me.
Yeah, good point. I never looked at that before. Yeah, that's a good. That's a really good point, though.
Right, and it's the same thing with daily self-care.
Yeah,
it's good for my own mental health, but you know what? It's really good for everybody around me.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so, you know, finding out what works for you, and that takes planning. You know, I can't. So my thing is, I like to run, but I can't stick running into my self-care plan at the same time that I get home in the evening and my family's expecting me to, because I'm the cook and they're expecting dinner on the table, because I'm going to sabotage myself every time.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm either going to be upset that they want dinner already and I'm going to have to cut my run short, or I'm not going to be able to run at all.
Yeah.
So it's all about planning, making sure that you have the time for whatever you're planning. And that plan has to be dynamic, has to be something that changes.
Mm-hmm.
I tell people often my daily self-care plan, when I was 22 looks very different now that I'm 48.
Of course, yes, of course, things change. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you have to take care of yourself first. I always tell people, you know, especially new officers, you know, you know, most of us have been on flights before, on planes. So what's the first thing that they tell you if, God forbid, something happens? You put the mask on yourself first before you start helping everybody else. So you
absolutely
you have to help yourself. You know, if you're not taking care of yourself, nothing else is going to matter because you're not going to be there to take care of other people. So
absolutely. And then the second part of self-care we look at is that trigger care. So what am I going to do to do that work to understand what my triggers are?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And then what am I going to do to stay present in the moment when I am triggered? So I often tell people, you know, find those things that kind of bring your executive functioning back on board. And usually that's something physical, but it can't be something that's necessarily noticed. So when I was sitting with someone, you know, in juvenile probation with a teen, I couldn't all of a sudden start deep breathing when they're pushing my buttons, because the last thing you want to do with a teenager is to start to take deep breaths. Because no. They're going to interpret that very differently.
Exactly.
But my trick for me to bring myself out of trigger mode was, inside my shoes, I would cross my toes. Because all of a sudden that action, like, immediately brought me back to the present moment.
Yeah, it's like a rubber band on your wrist. You know, you snap it, you know, maybe.
Exactly. So yeah. Whatever it is, but to find those things to care for yourself in those trigger moments. And then the last tier of stress that we talk about, you know, is the crisis, you know, the big thing that happens. And what are you going to do to care for yourself when that big thing happens? Because often those of us that do this kind of work are the rock, you know, we're the rock for our community, our family, our workplace. And so when a crisis happens, what do? We throw our own self-care out the window, right?
Yeah.
Take care of everybody else.
Exactly. Yeah, it's you're so right. So, but you know, the one thing I really like about Good Harbor Institute too is you work with, you work with higher education, right? You work with nonprofits,
yes.
And you work with
yes.
businesses. So you're running the spectrum, which is really cool because you're getting the message out.
Yeah, in fact, we've done several different conferences with HR directors of mm-hmm. private business, because you know, when you think about a workplace and that whole idea of, you know, people feeling like it's a toxic work environment. Mm-hmm. Well, where's that coming from? Something's going on that people are bringing in, and then people are misinterpreting, thinking it's personal, but it's really not personal. It's about something that happened somewhere else and people are being triggered. So it has implications kind of in a lot of different fields.
And I always tell people, maybe I don't know what your take on this, Kathy, is that people, my opinion is people never really leave a company or a business. They leave people, you know, to give an example, we've lost some officers in the last couple of years in my department, but it's not because of the department. Usually it's because of other people. Does that make
right.
sense?
Absolutely. Well,
maybe
I mean,
toxic people, you know, and stress and things like that.
Well, and a lot of times, so if, you know, I always tell people that when you start to learn this stuff, it actually really truly flattens out an organization. Mm-hmm. Because if I all of a sudden know that, you know, let's say I walk into my supervisor's office and, you know, to borrow a pencil, and my supervisor snaps at me, is abrasive. And then I walk out of that office and I go back to my cubicle and I talk to everybody around me. I can't believe that he did that, you know? What's his problem? He's always like that.
Yeah.
He's always so abrasive. But what if I turn that on its head and I instead walk out of there and go, I wonder what's going on. I hope he's all right.
Yep.
I wonder what's happening.
Yep, it's good.
Then I've turned it on its head, and I'm not coming back to my cubicle and sharing with all of my peers, you know what, this sucks. This, you know, he sucks. It becomes a whole different conversation.
Exactly.
So it's that understanding that it's, again, it's not about me. When mm-hmm. people act badly towards me, it's really not about me. It doesn't mean that I don't hold it accountable. But it does mean that I can take that piece out of it, and I don't have to respond in a way that's a reaction. I can instead choose my response.
But a lot of people respond to that, which, you know, and then they take it personally, and that's where the animosity builds, and, You know, like you said, I really love what you're saying about, you know, kind of don't take it. But it's harder. It's hard to practice that too. You know that. And
yeah,
but you know, absolutely. I think it's a little easier for people in law enforcement or in the criminal justice system, because, you know, we have to be that way a lot of times. I mean, that's what they teach you in the academies and in law enforcement. You know, if we chased people around all day, Kathy, that called us names, guess what? I wouldn't do anything else.
Right.
If
exactly.
I took it personally all the time, that's all I would do, to be chasing people down who called me a name or so. So,
but I think, you know, what's really important, this kind of goes back to, you know, this idea of caring for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We need to really protect ourselves from taking all those things personally, because it'll begin to wear us down and hurt us. So I was listening most recently to a talk of some, the Dalai Lama, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty heady stuff. But he was talking about this Buddhist master that right after they were all kicked out of Tibet, this Buddhist master, his temple was raided and he was arrested with everybody else that was in the temple. And he was imprisoned and forced to do hard labor and tortured for 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he was finally released and reunited with the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama said, you know, oh, I'm so glad that you're safe, and I'm so sorry everything that happened to you. And this Buddhist master looked at him and said, you know, I lived in fear for 18 years. And the Dalai Lama said, you know, I could understand that. And I told him, I understand, you know, to live in fear that you were going to be killed for 18 years. And he goes, no, I lived in fear that I was going to lose compassion for humanity.
Wow.
And the Chinese guards. And
wow,
that's what I was fearful every day.
That is that's profound. Wow! I thought it would have been the former, like you said, the, you know, just kind of losing, you know, just getting so cynical and bitter, obviously.
And I think that's really what it is for us, you know, that are first responders, is always keeping that at the forefront. That's the last thing we want to do is lose this idea of compassion for humanity, because that's why we all got into this work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is to serve people.
Well, why do you think that? What do you think some of the big? I'm sorry, I was going to ask you. What do you think some of the big issues in the criminal justice system are today? You were in law enforcement, and we talked a little bit about this before the show. But I mean, there's so much stuff going on there out there that you know, your law enforcement has to deal with these days.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, again, I don't think that we do a lot of training up front with our first responders in regards to taking care of themselves. In regards to, you know, we don't give them space to be able to get themselves the kind of support that they need and the help they need. So here's an example. When I worked as a paramedic, I had a pretty horrific scene that I responded to. Unfortunately, a man was trapped in his mobile home. It caught on fire. We were first on scene with law enforcement. I was working as a paramedic, but law enforcement and us were on scene first. And we tried to get in. It was before the fire department arrived, and he had oxygen tanks that were just delivered on his front porch.
Oh, geez, yeah.
And so they shot off the porch, and we had to stay on scene. Fire department arrived. You know, there was nothing we could do to rescue this man. But as paramedics, we just stay on scene because we were also the medical examiners for our county. So we had to retrieve the body. So here's a scene where I rolled onto scene and I could hear the man screaming for help, and I had to stay on scene and retrieve his body. And there was a lot of, you know, push, of course, to have us, oh, you know, you need to access your help. You need to, you know, go see the counselor.
Yeah.
And, but yet there was this idea too that, okay, you go do your mandatory session and then I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be fine.
Back to work.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that we need to, you know, when we're in these professional circles where we have this opportunity to do the training, when we're in the academies as the instructors, we really have to push this idea that, you know what, no, that's going to haunt you.
Yeah.
And it's going to haunt you in bad ways. And you need to take care of yourself. And it's actually less responsible to not do that kind of work.
Like, have you ever heard of Dr. Kevin Gilmartin?
I have not, no.
He really very popular in law enforcement circles. Anyway, he wrote a book called Emotional Wellness, a law enforcement guide to emotional wellness for the officers and their families. And we actually, we were lucky enough to get him to come and talk to my agency and a bunch of other agencies. And really, and he's talking exactly what you're talking about, Kathy. We need to, we need to teach and we need to educate, you know, the young people in the academies and criminal justice people who want to get into the profession. But you're exactly right. We need to, you know, we teach, you know, cadets and officers how to shoot and drive and, you know, do use, you know, handcuff, which is all important.
Right.
But we need to spend more time, exactly what you're saying and exactly what this author is saying, taking care of ourselves. Because like you said, it's going to haunt us if we don't take care of ourselves, learn how to take care of ourselves, learn how to open up and talk to people. It really is detrimental to our health down the road.
Well, I think that, you know, one of my favorite authors in regards to that, have you heard of Dr. Bessel van der Kolk?
I have not, no.
Okay, so he did the very first work with Vietnam vets and PTSD.
Oh, okay.
He wrote the book, The Body Keeps the Score. He's now the head of the Boston Trauma Center and works with people that have experienced trauma from vets to people that have experienced childhood sexual abuse to teens that have been physically abused. And his whole book, and it's a tough book to get through because it's, you know, he's a medical doctor.
Sure.
But if you piece it out, it really begins to lay it out for you what this kind of stuff does to us on a physical level, not just an emotional level, but on a physical level if we don't address it. And that's when I read that book, that's when I started to say, okay, I really need to pay attention to what I'm doing for myself.
Yeah.
Because if I want to be around for my family, you know what? So if I were still in law enforcement, I would be thinking about things like, yeah, I want to be around for my family, so I'm going to make sure that I stay as safe as I can every night that I go out, right?
Exactly. And taking care of yourself, like you said.
That's the thing that's going to keep us most safe, is taking care of ourselves emotionally.
Yeah.
And making sure that we do that tough work. And again, it circles right back around to how we started this conversation. If I'm going to be that person, that stable, positive adult person, I also have to do that work.
Exactly. Got to put in the time. Well, Kathy, I thank you so much for being here today. If people want to reach out to you, Kathy, how do they find you? And please, the Good Harbor Institute, how do they find that?
Well, we have webpage, www.goodharbor, and then it's inst.com. My email address is on there, and I answer my own email, so feel free to reach out to me. We're also on Twitter at Good Harbor INST, and we have a Good Harbor Institute Facebook page.
Nice. And all of those will be in the show notes for everybody who is interested in the Good Harbor Institute services and wants to reach out to the good doctor. So, Kathy, thank you so much for coming on the show. We sure do appreciate it, and it was an education.
Thank you, Patrick. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.